Hello, this is Rory Groves, and you are listening to a recording from the Grovestead Gathering. We made these recordings to serve as a fundraiser for our own family economy. If you would like to share this or listen to other recordings we've made, please visit our website at thegrovestead.com. Thanks for listening.
Okay, all right. I can hear myself now. So this talk is entitled In the House of Tom Bombadil, and as I think I've noted, it's based on the book that will be coming out hopefully within the next couple of months of the same title. So let me just jump right into it. The title of my talk, as I noted, is In the House of Tom Bombadil. If you're familiar with Tom from The Lord of the Rings, I imagine that you're just as puzzled by his inclusion in a conference on household economy as you were by his presence in Tolkien's trilogy, The Lord of the Rings. What could the enigmatic and apparently ridiculous Tom possibly say to us? Hopefully you've actually read the trilogy, because if you haven't and your knowledge of Lord of the Rings is limited to Peter Jackson's films, I'm afraid you're at a disadvantage when it comes to what follows, because obviously he was left out. Actually, I'm glad that Jackson left Bombadil out of his films, since I won't have to clear away any of the residue from your minds before I begin. First, let's review. Lord of the Rings is about overcoming temptation. The occasion of the temptation is a powerful magic ring, which not incidentally resembles the ring of Gyges from Plato's Republic, insofar as both make the wearer invisible. So I hope that doesn't disillusion you. Tolkien didn't invent the idea of the magic ring that makes you invisible. There are actually lots of rings that do that. Now, I say not incidentally because Tolkien was a great scholar, and undoubtedly he knew about the Ring of Gyges. And the Ring of Gyges illustrated the wickedness of the human heart in the Republic. But the ring of Lord of the Rings is far more powerful than the one in the Republic. It's the product of Sauron, a supernatural being who may just be the most powerful creature in Middle-earth. Like the rest of us, Sauron is hell-bent on dominating everything around him. But unlike you or me, he actually forged a ring to get the job done. His incantation toward the end is inscribed on the ring itself. One ring to rule them all, one ring to find them, one ring to bring them all in the darkness, bind them. The all here refers to other rings. Here's the rest of the verses. Three rings for the elven kings under the sky. Seven for the dwarf lords in their halls of stone. Nine for mortal men doomed to die. One for the dark lord on his dark throne in the land of Mordor where the shadows lie. Those rings were forged with different purposes or several purposes in mind, but Sauron's ring was a gambit to control them, and in so doing bring the races of Middle-earth under his control. But his subtlety was detected and war follows. At the end of that war, the ring was cut from Sauron's hand. Sadly, it was not destroyed at that point. Instead, it was eventually lost in a river, and then oddly, even providentially, after thousands of years, it finds its way into the hands of a small creature with very little interest in dominating anyone, a hobbit named Frodo. Obviously, it was initially found by Bilbo, but Bilbo gave it to Frodo. Frodo is advised by a wizard named Gandalf to take his faithful servant Samwise and go to Elrond, half-elven, the greatest lore master in Middle-earth, in order to determine what's to be done with the ring. Unfortunately, Gandalf is prevented from accompanying them, but two other hobbit friends join Frodo and Sam. Those are Merry and Pippin, of course, and the four of them set out, but from the start, they are pursued by agents of Sauron. To escape pursuit, the hobbits enter the mysterious and very ancient forest, fittingly called the Old Forest. Now, what happens then is reminiscent of the saying, out of the frying pan and into the fire, because in the Old Forest, they come under the spell of a malevolent and very powerful willow tree, known as Old Man Willow. The tree dominates the forest in a manner reminiscent of Sauron, and before long, two of the hobbits find themselves trapped inside it, and a third is nearly drowned by it. Now, concerning the forest and the willow, here's what we learn later in Lord of the Rings. Quote, the hearts of trees and their thoughts are often dark and strange and filled with hatred of things that go about free upon the earth, gnawing, biting, breaking, hacking, burning, destroyers and usurpers. It is not called the old forest for without reason, for it is indeed ancient, a survivor of vast forgotten woods. And in it there lived yet, aging no quicker than the hills, the fathers of trees, remembering times when they were lords. The countless years had filled them with pride and rooted wisdom and with malice, but none were more dangerous than the great willow. His heart was rotten, but his strength was green. And he was cunning and master of winds, and his song and thought ran through the woods on both sides of the river. His gray, thirsty spirit drew power out of the earth and spread like fine root threads in the ground and invisible twig fingers in the air, till it had under its dominion nearly all the trees of the forest. Fortunately for the hobbits, someone even more powerful than the old willow comes along in the nick of time. His name, if you haven't guessed it already, is Tom Bombadil. We learn Tom's name because the fellow can't stop singing about himself. As he comes traipsing by, this is what the hobbits hear. Hey, dole, merry dole, ring-a-dong-dillo, hop, ring-a-dong, hop along, fa-la-la-willow. Jolly Bomb, Jolly Tom, Tom Bombadillo. Hey, come, merry dole, dairy dole, my darling. Night goes the weather wind and the feathered starling. Down along under hill, shining in the starlight, waiting on the doorstep for the cold starlight. There my pretty lady is, river woman's daughter, slender as a willow wand, clearer than the water. Old Tom Bombadil, water lilies bringing, comes hopping home again. Can you hear him singing? Hey, come, merry dole, dairy dole, and merry o, goldberry, goldberry, merry yellow berry o. I'm going to say that five times fast. Poor old willow man, tuck your roots away. Tom's in a hurry now, evening will follow day. Tom's going home again, water lilies bringing. Hey, come, dairy dole, can you hear me singing? After this, Tom Bombadil emerges. Here's Tolkien's delightful description. There was another burst of song, and then suddenly, hopping and dancing along the path, there appeared above the reeds an old battered hat with a tall crown and a long blue feather stuck in the band. With another hop and a bound, there came into view a man, or so it seemed. At any rate, he was too large and heavy for a hobbit, if not quite tall enough for one of the big people. Though he made enough noise for one, stomping along with his great yellow boots on his thick legs and charging through the grass and the rushes like a cow going down to drink. He had a blue coat and a long brown beard. His eyes were blue and bright, and his face was as red as a ripe apple, but creased in 100 wrinkles of laughter. In his hands he carried, as on a large leaf, as on a tray, a small pile of white water lilies. Now this is followed by a striking deliverance. After being told by Frodo and Sam that their friends are trapped inside the willow, Tom literally sings them free. You heard that right. He delivers them with nothing more than a song. After that, the capering and boisterous Tom invites the hobbits to his house, and then without waiting for them, he bounds out of sight. The bewildered hobbits trudge along after, and just as the sun is going down, making the way difficult to see, they spy Tom's house in the distance, a door open, light streams out, and Tom's wife, Goldberry, a figure nearly as mysterious as Tom, sings them the rest of the way into the house. Then, she says, "Come, dear folk," taking Frodo by the hand, "laugh and be merry. I am Goldberry, daughter of the river." Then lightly she passed them, and closing the door, she turned her back to it, with her white arms spread across it. "Let us shut out the night," she said, "for you are still afraid, perhaps, of mist and tree shadows and deep water and untamed things. Fear nothing, for tonight you are under the roof of Tom Bombadil." What follows is a delightful stay lasting two nights and a day. The house of Tom Bombadil proves to be a safe haven in a perilous land. Now, who is this guy? Just who is Tom Bombadil? Fortunately for the reader, Frodo thinks to ask this very question to the people in the know, and what they say is powerfully suggestive. Here's Frodo's question to Goldberry and her reply. "Fair lady," said Frodo, Tell me if my asking does not seem foolish. Who is Tom Bombadil? He is, said Goldberry, staying her swift movements and smiling. Frodo looked at her questioningly. He is as you have seen him, she said in answer to his look. He is master of wood, water, and hill. Then all this strange land belongs to him? No, indeed, she answered, and her smile faded. That would indeed be a burden. She added in a low voice as if to herself, the trees and the grasses and all things growing or living in the land belong each to themselves. Tom Bombadil is master. No one has ever caught old Tom walking in the forest, wading in the water, leaping on the hilltops. Under light and shadow, he has no fear. Tom Bombadil is master. A door opened, and in came Tom Bombadil. He had now no hat, and his thick brown hair was crowned with autumn leaves. End of quote. So Tom is master. And as a sign, if you will, Tom appears with his forest crown. But Frodo wants to know more. So next day, after Tom has regaled the hobbits with many remarkable stories, Frodo asks Tom directly, who are you, master? Here is his reply. Hey, what? Said Tom, sitting up and his eyes glinting in the gloom. Don't you know my name yet? That's the only answer. Tell me, who are you, alone, yourself, and nameless? But you are young, and I am old. Eldest, that's what I am. Mark my words, my friends. Tom was here before the rivers and the trees. Tom remembers the first raindrop and the first acorn. So Tom is the old master. Now, Tom doesn't look like a master. He looks more like a jester. Goldberry says he's never been caught, and Tom says the same, and somehow that's relevant. In search for an explanation, my mind ran to virtue, particularly self-control, the mastery of oneself, but Tom doesn't strike me as someone who is exercising self-control. There's no evidence that there's even a struggle. Instead, I see amusement, the sort of playfulness you get when fathers wrestle with toddlers. Feigned effort, lots of laughing. I think something of that comes through when Tom asked Frodo to see the ring. Show me the precious ring, he said, suddenly in the midst of the story. And Frodo, to his own astonishment, drew out the chain from his pocket, and unfastening the ring, handed it over at once to Tom. It seemed to grow larger as it lay for a moment on his big brown-skinned hand. Then suddenly, he put it to his eye and laughed. For a second, the hobbits had a vision, both comical and alarming, of his bright blue eye gleaming through the circle of gold. Then Tom put the ring around the end of his little finger and held it up to the candlelight. For a moment, the hobbits noticed nothing strange about this. Then they gasped. There was no sign of Tom disappearing. Tom laughed again, and then he spun the ring in the air, and it vanished in a flash. Frodo gave a cry, and Tom leaned forward and handed it back to him with a smile. Now, what have we here? Tom makes light of something Frodo will eventually find too heavy to bear. And Tom doesn't disappear. Instead, he makes the ring disappear. So does Tom's mastery extend even to the ring? Many theories have been suggested for just who or what Tom is, but no one can say for sure, maybe not even Tolkien. In this talk, I'm interested in entertaining a different sort of question, a how question, as in how come Tom can't be caught? Or how is he the master when things each belong to themselves? And how is it possible for the light-hearted Tom to take Sauron's ring so lightly? In the course of their time in Tom's house, the hobbits learn that Tom knows many things. Quote, he told them many remarkable stories, sometimes half as if speaking to himself, sometimes looking at them suddenly with a bright blue eye under his deep brows. Often his voice would turn to song, and he would get out of his chair and dance about. He told them tales of bees and flowers, the ways of trees and the strange creatures of the forest, about evil things and good things, things friendly and things unfriendly, cruel things and kind things, and secrets hidden under brambles. He even knew the hobbits better than he let on. Quote, he appeared already to know much about them and all their families, and indeed to know much of all the history of the doings of the Shire down from the days hardly remembered among the hobbits themselves. End of quote. The word lore is an old-fashioned word for knowledge, and I suspect that Tolkien preferred it to the word knowledge. Its root means furrow or track. This seems to imply that lore is something to follow, something that takes us somewhere, something to obey. On the face of it, knowledge of that kind looks like servitude, but paradoxically, it's the kind of truth that makes you free. By contrast, for modern people, knowledge is power. You might be familiar with that statement from Francis Bacon. Knowledge of this sort is believed to be amoral and free of moral encumbrances. But freeing knowledge from morality is actually a kind of trap. Allow me to illustrate with another character from the story. In The Lord of the Rings, there is someone who seeks knowledge of this kind, the amoral kind. His name is Saruman. And he's a wizard like Gandalf, but he's a traitor. As Gandalf shows when he recalls a conversation with him. And here's the conversation. "You have come, and that was all the purpose of my message. And here you will stay, Gandalf the Grey, and rest from your journeys, for I am Saruman the Wise, Saruman the Ringmaker, Saruman of many colors." I looked then and saw that his robes, which had seemed white, were not so, but were woven of all colors, and if he moved, they shimmered and changed hues so that the eye was bewildered. "I liked white better," said Gandalf. "White," he sneered, "it serves as a beginning. White cloth may be dyed, the white page may be overwritten, the white light can be broken. In which case it is no longer white," said Gandalf, "and he that breaks a thing to find out what it is has left the path of wisdom. You need not speak to me as to one of the fools that you take for friends," said he. "I have not brought you hither to be instructed by you, but to give you a choice." He drew himself up then and began to declaim, as if he was were making a speech long rehearsed. "The elder days are gone, the middle days are passing, the younger days are beginning. The time of the elves is over, but our time is at hand, the world of men, which we must rule. But we must have power, power to order all things as we will, for the good which only the wise can see. And listen, Gandalf, my old friend and helper," he said, coming near and speaking now in a softer voice. "I said we, for we it may be, if you join with me." When Gandalf refuses the offer, Saruman changes his tone. "I did not expect you to show wisdom in your own behalf, but I gave you the chance of aiding me willingly and saving yourself much trouble and pain. The third choice is to stay here until the end." "Until what end?" "Until you reveal to me where the One may be found." Of course, the One is the ring. So Saruman breaks things to know them, and that includes people. Knowledge is power. Power indeed. By the way, I'm pretty sure that Tolkien had Newton and his experiments with optics and prisms in mind when he created that scene with Saruman and the robe of many colors. He wasn't thinking about Joseph. By contrast, Bombadil used his lore to free the hobbits and stay free himself. What did Bombadil know that Saruman did not? What Gandalf points out, the path, or the furrow of wisdom, is what Bombadil knew. Bombadil's power doesn't come from good intentions. Its source is deeper than that. I believe it arises from what he knows. Now, how do I know? Well, I can't say for certain. It's my educated guess, my hypothesis, but I believe there's evidence for my thesis. It's the singing that clued me in. Bombadil's silly, nonsense singing, or so it seemed. Tolkien was a fussy writer, so when he makes an aside, we should pay attention. Here's the aside I'm thinking about, referring to Bombadil. Suddenly, out of a long string of nonsense words, or so they seemed, the voice rose up loud and clear and burst into song. There's something to the songs. He saved the hobbits with one, and he saves them later in the story again at the Barrow Downs. And that got me thinking, where else is there singing in Tolkien? Sure, there is a lot of singing in a lot of places, but what was the first place? In the Silmarillion, Tolkien's posthumously published legendarium that informed The Lord of the Rings, we're given the story of creation. And there we learn that music played a key role. Middle-earth was actually sung into being. Raw power wasn't the basis of its order. Instead, the basis of order and of being itself is harmony. If you're not familiar with the Silmarillion, here's how the music is described in the first chapter. In the beginning, there was Eru, the One, who in Arda is known as Ilúvatar. And he made first the Ainur, the Holy Ones, that were the offspring of his thought. And they were with him before aught else was made. And he spoke to them and propounded to them themes of music. And they sang before him, and he was glad. But for a long while they sang only each alone, or but a few together, while the rest hearkened, for each comprehended only that part of the mind of Ilúvatar from which he came. And in understanding of their brethren, they grew but slowly, yet ever as they listened, they came to deeper understanding and increased in unison and harmony. End of quote. What follows this is a grand chorus, and as the song moves along, different themes run through it. But as the song is sung, a singer named Melkor introduces disharmony, and some near him join in the dissonance. What follows is a conflict that threatens to descend into chaos. But Ilúvatar introduces a new theme, and then another, and saves the song and even enfolds the disharmony into it. When the music is complete, this follows. Then Ilúvatar spoke, and he said, "Mighty are the Ainur, and mightiest among them is Melkor. But that he may know, and all the Ainur, that I am Ilúvatar, those things that ye have sung I will show forth, that you may see what ye have done." Ilúvatar then reveals that the song has become the flesh and blood of a new world, the world in which The Lord of the Rings and every other story in Tolkien's legendarium is told. Today, many people rely on science to define reality. According to these folks, if science can't know something, there's nothing to know. That's called logical positivism. But science can't even explain its own story scientifically. On the other hand, and on its own terms, Christianity is the revelation of ultimate reality, reality with a capital R. And like Tolkien's Arda, according to the Christian faith, the world that we live in was made from the outside. In Christianity, if anything is unnecessary, it is the world, not God. But what is necessary is the one who made it. Here's how the Apostle John put it in the introduction to his gospel. Quote, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made." So, like Christianity, in the Silmarillion, there is a fall into disharmony. Since our world has that much in common with Tolkien's fictional world, perhaps Tolkien is saying something about the path of wisdom in our world with Tom Bombadil. Let's reflect on the nature of Tom's mastery. Tom is master. Another way to put it is this: he exercises dominion in his domain. Dominion has gotten a lot of bad press. It's an odd thing in a way, because without it, we wouldn't have many of the things that make life livable. The exercise of dominion, in some sense, is inevitable. After all, we must make a home for ourselves in the world, a domus, which is Latin for home. Domus, by the way, is the source of the words dominion, domination, domain, and of course, domestic. For Christians and Jews, people who believe in the Bible, human beings have been given this world in order to make a home out of it. Here's the pregnant passage from the book of Genesis. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them. And God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth. Genesis 1, 27 through 28. The Hebrew word that's translated dominion means something like skilled mastery. And that's definitely what we see when we look at Tom. But skilled mastery can be a problem, as we see with the ring of power. By the way, the name Saruman means man of skill. Tolkien was a philologist. He knew all about languages. I'm saying nothing that he wouldn't have known. When we see the ring of power in action, we see something very different than Tom Bombadil. When it comes to the ring, we see skill is used in a domineering way. One of the devilish things about knowledge today is that it's sued for divorce from wisdom. They're not even on speaking terms in most minds. Human wisdom was once based on a deeper wisdom written into the world, and it could only be acquired through dedicated and grateful study. But for many modern people, there's nothing to be grateful for because there's no one to thank. Instead of wisdom, many people are after facts that they can use. This underlies much of what goes by the name science today. Perhaps surprisingly, Tolkien's good friend C.S. Lewis actually saw a connection between science and magic. Here's something from his book, The Abolition of Man. Quote, there is something which unites magic and applied science, or technology, while separating both from the wisdom of earlier ages. For the wise men of old, the cardinal problem had been how to conform the soul to reality, and the solution had been knowledge, self-discipline, and virtue. For magic and applied science alike, the problem is how to subdue reality to the wishes of men. The solution is a technique. End of quote. Now, what do we have with Tom Bombadil? What does this have to do with him? I think a lot. The Lord of the Rings contains many things, and one of those things is an important distinction. Throughout the Lord of the Rings, the good professor, and I'm referring to Tolkien, by the way, professor just means to profess. A professor is someone who speaks and makes professions. So when you think about a professor in a college, that's the task of a professor, is to speak, to proclaim things that are true. So in the Lord of the Rings, the good professor is careful to distinguish between dominion and domination. He distinguishes those two. We need to learn how to distinguish them for ourselves because very often they get blended up in unprincipled and tendentious ways. So here's my point in a nutshell. Tom is an image of what true dominion looks like. Is this really something that Tolkien had in mind when he wrote about Tom? Yes, I think so. At least in part. He could be very clear about his beliefs, especially in the context of anything he wrote about fairy tales. And in his letters. Take this for example. Quote, the love of fairy is the love of love, a relationship toward all things, animate and inanimate, which includes love and respect and removes or modifies the spirit of possession and domination. Without it, even plain utility will in fact become less useful or will turn to ruthlessness and lead only to mere power. Ultimately destructive. In the modern world, the quest for knowledge is premised on the belief that the natural world is nothing more than a vast machine. Since it is merely a machine, learning how it works entails disassembly, breaking things down to their constituent parts. Unfortunately for the things themselves, this is something of a downgrade from the ways that they were once understood. Everything from trees to rivers to people, nothing is exempt. Whenever I hear the car go by, I think it's starting to rain. So. Now, because they are just things, they can be reassembled in novel ways. Think about Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. That's exactly what she was getting at. All this is implicit in Saruman's attitude and behavior. He's a magician, in the sense C.S. Lewis so aptly described. In contrast, Gandalf spoke up for an older way of knowing. A way that knows things without breaking them. In the old way of knowing, things are, quote, more than the sum of their parts. If you've ever heard that statement, now you know what it's referring to. It's actually referring to this matter, this long debate in the history of the West. And hopefully you can see the wisdom in that way of knowing. After all, you are more than the sum of your parts. You are not a machine. You are a human being with a name and an identity and a will of your own. You have a human nature, something that can only be disassembled at the price of your life and your humanity. Are you familiar with transhumanism, posthumanism? It's all about that. If you see the world the way Saruman does, you'll come to resemble a machine yourself. That's the way things work. Whatever we think is the final truth of things, that's what we conform to. In The Lord of the Rings, we're told that Saruman, this is in the words of Treebeard, Saruman has a mind of metal and wheels, and he did not care for growing things except as far as they serve him for the moment. Now let's contrast that with Tom. Saruman set a trap for Gandalf, but Tom set the hobbits free from Old Man Willow. What this demonstrates isn't just that Tom is good and Saruman isn't, but how two different understandings of knowledge work themselves out in different ways. One catches things to control them, and another frees them in order to commune with them. So that's the second contrast that you see with Tom and other sort of characters in Lord of the Rings. Domination versus dominion, control versus communion. There's this great scene in which Treebeard meets Merry and Pippin, and I think it's Merry, maybe it's Pippin, and says, "Please, would you mind telling us what you intend to do with us?" And Treebeard says, "Intend to do with you? If by, you know, intend to do with you, you mean do something to you, nothing." Then he says, "But we can do some things together." That's communion. And in Lord of the Rings, all the good characters respect the choices of the weaker characters. You go through it, you'll notice that Aragorn and Gandalf and Elrond and Galadriel, none of them try to take the ring by force from Frodo. Any of them could at any time they wanted. All the powerful good characters who exercise dominion in the right way exercise it in the way I just described. So anyway, things belong to themselves, and yet there is a master. Does that strike you as odd? Think about it this way. Tom's mastery is limited. He doesn't own things. He doesn't break them. Instead, he knows them in a different way. Tom tells the hobbits that he's the eldest. So when you're old, you should know more than young folks. And since Tom is the oldest of all, he should know the most. With that in mind, the question occurred to me, is Tom old enough to remember the song of the Ainur? If so, perhaps he knows the songs that gave created things their natures. I'd like to take a moment to reflect upon something in sort of this vein in our own world, the quest for Adamic language, the language of Adam. We're told in Genesis that the animals were brought to Adam so that he could name them. But how did he go about that? Did he just make up names arbitrarily, or did he base their names on something? If the latter, it must in some way they must in some way express the natures of the things named. With this in mind, it was once believed that recovering Adamic language might help restore the dominion that was lost when Adam and Eve were expelled from paradise. This is actually a field of study in the Renaissance, the quest for the Adamic language. One hypothesis was that Hebrew might be Adamic in nature. After all, the Old Testament was written in it. Another theory was that all human languages are somehow adulterations of an original language, and so philologists set out to discover that original language. But they didn't get very far in their quest for it. Families of languages could be traced back to common ancestors. Indo-European is the classic example, the mother tongue of many European tongues, Finnish and Basque being notable exceptions. But philology proved to be a dead end when it came to distilling the original Adamic language. But this, as odd as this may sound, there was another way back to an original primordial language. And that became the language that we are familiar with today. It's the way of mathematics. How can math give us a language with which to exercise dominion? Here's Galileo, the Galileo, explaining how. Quote, philosophy is written in this grand book, the universe, which stands continually open to our gaze. But the book cannot be understood unless one first learns to comprehend the language and read the letters in which it is composed. It is written in the language of mathematics, and its characters are triangles, circles, and other geometric figures, without which it is humanly impossible to understand a single word of it. Without these, one wanders about in a dark labyrinth. End of quote. Now, the notion that you could use mathematics to understand the world may seem like a modern idea, but in fact it's a very old idea. For one, it's the way of the quadrivium, which is a branch of the liberal arts, and what this way was believed to lead you to may come as a surprise. Classical education was something the Inklings, you know, Tolkien and C.S. Lewis and a few others, Charles Williams and so forth, were part of a group called the Inklings. They understood classical education very well. And there was an honorary Inkling, Dorothy Sayers. She actually knew the Inklings, didn't come to their meetings, but she knew them well. And she actually wrote a book calling for its recovery entitled The Lost Tools of Learning. It consisted of seven fields of study broken down into two groups. The trivium for three, which followed this progression, grammar, logic, and rhetoric. And a second group, the quadrivium, for four, which follows another progression, arithmetic, geometry, astronomy, and get this, music. Music is the highest expression of mathematics, in other words. Now, I've ambled on for a little while, and I've talked about knowledge and wisdom, domination and dominion, and how natures and now natures and harmonies. I need to arrive at my point. Let's see if I can do that with Tom and Goldberry's household. A beautiful harmony can be sensed in Tom's house. We see it in the mundane routines of Tom and Goldberry. Even when Tom's not singing, his words have a lyrical quality. And Goldberry's movements as she lights candles and tends the table are as graceful as a dance. When they speak or move in concert, there seems to be music that only they can hear. Even though Tom and Goldberry seem to embody different themes, Tom, I think, embodies earth and Goldberry water. I get into that in my book. This is what we see when they set the table for the hobbits. Quote, yet in some fashion they seem to weave a single dance, neither hindering the other. In and out of the room and round about the table, and with great speed food and vessels and lights were set in order. End of quote. And once their preparations are complete, in a blink, without explanation or observation, they appear before the hobbits in formal wear, dressed as for the evening meal. Then begins a jolly time. And before long, the hobbits have apparently picked up the tune. After drinking what appears to be nothing more than water, the hobbits are singing merrily, as though singing was, quote, more natural than talking. That's a quote from Lord of the Rings. More natural than talking. That's a telling way of putting it. Here's a little inside information. In Tolkien's Legendarium, we learn that a little of the music of the Ainur can be heard in the waters of Middle-earth. Quote, Olmo, is one of the Ainur, govern the flowing of all waters and the course of all rivers, the replenishment of springs and the distilling of rain, the dew throughout the world. In the deep places he gives thought to music great and terrible, and the echo thereof runs through all the veins of the earth. End of quote. Nature's living in harmony is something that our ancestors would have recognized on sight, but which requires a word of explanation today. Tom and Goldberry's dance about the table, setting dishes and lighting candles, says something. Their movements are set within a world made with creative intent. They are participating in something grand, something larger than themselves. If the world we live in is also a work of art, why can't we hear music ringing in our ears the way that Tom and Goldberry seem to? Could it have something to do with how we perceive things? Are we even listening? Do we want to? We live in a tone-deaf time, and we behave as though there's no natural order to harmonize with. Instead, like Saruman, we think that the world should just do what we tell it to do. Naturally, if that is all there is to it, then freedom is nothing more than doing what you want to do, and laws and customs can be boiled down to some people bossing other people around. The suspicion that this is all there is to it now runs so deep in our time that even marriage, as the happy harmony of a man and wife, has been lost. It has been deconstructed in the interest of liberation. And what we see in Tom and Goldberry is more an exception than the rule today. But if Tolkien is saying something true about our world, with his imaginary world, then the music is still playing in our world, and we need to, in our time, and what we need in our time is our hearing restored. Now, when it came to Old Man Willow, the way Tom delivered the hobbits was by calling the tree back to its true nature. Quote, "Eat earth, dig deep, drink water, go to sleep. Bombadil is talking." End of quote. Tom knew what things are for. In philosophy, knowing what things are for can be referred to as formal causation or final causation, what they are and what they're destined for. And just like Saruman, many people don't like this because it means that things are not subject to their control. Now, with this in mind, I think we can say that Bombadil's power doesn't come from breaking and remaking. It comes from agreeing. He knew the tunes. It's the power of amen. So let it be. Amen. And the same can be true for us. God has given us a nature, human nature. We have been made in his image, but he also has given us natures in two keys, male and female. And when we know these keys, we can make beautiful music together, exercising dominion and making a home in a world that we've been given. So learn the tune, sing your parts, and let the world stand back and wonder as you sing in harmony together in your homes. That's it. Anyways, there's a lot of stuff that I just touch on pretty lightly, and I'd be happy to talk about it in more depth. And that's what the book is for. It'll be out hopefully in a couple months.
We've got a couple minutes if there's any questions right here. Anyone have any questions?
Question for you about poetry. You mentioned something earlier about importance of that, and I'm hearing you talk about languages and
right.
Music. Can you tie those thoughts together for us?
Yeah, well, poesis just means making. That's where we get the word poetry. So a poet, classically understood, was anybody who made things. Specifically things like, you know, obviously poems, but music, stories, those sorts of things. And it's a very powerful way of communicating. And it's most powerful when it's sort of tapping into some larger reality. So that's why certain works of art are perennial. They continue to endure. And why some maybe have their moment in the sun and pass away. Poesis, poetry, is a very significant thing if we understand it in the sense I just described. One of the reasons why poetry has been downgraded and is sort of thought of in the way it is today is we don't believe that poetry actually does tap into higher realities anymore. Most people today think it's just a means of self-expression, just kind of like it's my truth, you know, whatever. And there's really no interest in, you know, sort of the disciplines that are required in order to tap into larger realities, you know. So, you know, in the visual arts, you know, draftsmanship, you got to be able to, a classically trained artist needs to know how to render accurate presentations of, real physical reality, human to figure, objects, that kind of thing. Nobody's interested in learning those disciplines anymore. And the same thing's true with music. The quality of music is just, I'm not a musician myself, but the people who know a lot more about music will listen to stuff, even stuff, popular music from the 50s and 60s and 70s, and say the musicianship is just so much higher in those days. And a lot of those guys were classically educated, classically trained musically. They really were masters of their musical crafts. But, you know, that's all kind of broken down. People don't really believe in transcendent truths, realities, values. So it's just about what's going on the inside, you know, kind of finding a way out. And since most people are a mess, it's very messy. You know, there's some stuff in there that's okay, but it's usually blended in with a lot of other stuff. It's like mixing together ice cream and mud, you know, real mud, not chocolate. It's all mixed up.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Chris.
Yeah. I hope it was helpful. I guess, you know, just sort of quickly summarize what I was attempting to do with that is just show how in our households we are trying to reflect a larger reality that's, you know, sort of given in our natures as male and female.